Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a nonprofit with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Change menus, change lives. Learn more at chefscollaborative.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half of your host, Darren Bresnitz, sitting with the awesome Laura Werner in the gorgeous pasture in Auckland. Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thanks.
So for those, because I think you really need to lay the mission statement out of what pasture is before we get into the whole interview. For those unfamiliar with pasture, how would you sum it up in a couple sentences?
It's tough. We wanted to create a restaurant which captured all our favorite parts of dining. So something really small, independent, with a lot of authenticity and integrity behind what we produce.
Beautiful. Let's dial it back a little bit.
Okay.
How did you and your husband, Ed, who's the head chef here, how did you two meet?
I used to work as a professional photographer.
Okay.
And I had a focus on lots of food and lifestyle assignments, and I was lucky enough to be photographing an event in a restaurant that he used to work at in Auckland called Siddharth.
Oh, and, legendary.
Yeah.
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 And photographed this dinner there, and I was really drawn to this chef who was really kind of like, he was so focused when he was plating. And it was interesting, like, just, yeah, there was just a really great synergy there. So that was 4.5 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And just over that summer, our relationship grew. And
did you go up to him and be like, I might need your number or your email to send you some of these, like, test photos?
No, it took a few months for us to be able to, like, have a conversation.
But did you know from the first time you saw him?
I was really drawn to him. But, yeah, there were other circumstances involved. So it just took us a bit of time to connect.
Yeah. So he was always a chef, but you've had a pretty awesome and varied background. Photographer, and then you did community development and things like that.
Yeah, I was doing community development first. I studied literature, and that was like my main focus in university. But it led me to study a lot of historical papers, and that took me into social work of all things. So I grew up in South Africa and I studied in Cape Town.
Gotcha.
And, it was social work that really, I decided that was my vocation, but I had this creative bent. And what I really loved about community development is that you engage with people on a really deep way, and you're engaging with, this concept that we're not lone individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about strengthening networks, strengthening support systems around individuals and communities, and often the arts or physical activity can be a great platform to do that, because it's non-threatening, encourages people to get involved, and builds really tangible connections. So social work through the arts was the focus of most of my 20s, and then that led into social work through gardening, community gardening.
Through gardening?
Yeah.
How did you get there? I mean,
there was a community in Wellington, mm-hmm. which is where I was living at the time, and it was a community garden set up for migrant women.
Mm-hmm.
The philosophy behind it is that, often migrant communities are coming to a new country and they have a lot of food or ways of growing things,
sure.
even their own seeds, and to set up a space that was just for women, because there were several, migrant communities there where women, weren't working. So
yeah.
there are opportunities to meet other women, to, have opportunities to connect to New Zealand society were actually really quite limited, and that was an issue. But then creating this beautiful space where women could come together and garden and connect, and then
it's beautiful.
We'd have shared dinners all the time, and like people would make these amazing dishes.
What were you growing, or what were they growing?
I think a lot of leafy greens that I'd never heard of. I mean, Wellington's an interesting place. It's very windy, which is good for bugs and gardens, because often they can't land on things. There's a lot of wind just kind of blowing away things. But it was. We had one site initially, and then that grew to two. Actually, the council gave us an old bowling green, which we had to which was remediated. The soil health was remediated through mushrooms.
Ooh,
very interesting stuff.
That sounds both good for Mother Nature and also for cooking in the kitchen.
Yeah, I wouldn't have eaten those guys because they like pull the toxins.
Oh, they're pulling all the toxins. Never mind. Good for the compost pile then.
Yeah.
So it sounds like a lot of your work with at least community building and then also gardening at what point did it start to trickle into your brain, especially since you had a relationship with a chef as well, that you're going, like, maybe a restaurant?
Yeah, I mean, for me, this it's an interesting journey that, like, led me here. I mean, Ed's the kind of person who, being a chef, is who he is,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I have so much respect for people like this because I'm quite different. I'm stimulated by a lot of different things.
Sure.
I feel like I could do many different things and I'd probably be just as happy doing many of them as long
sure.
as it had the values that make me tick. He is through and through a chef. Like, oh. He lives food, breathes food.
Seeing him at the line last night, yeah. I was like, this guy is a chef.
Yeah.
It's not a passing fancy.
No. It's very real for him. And, yeah, me doing my own thing and him doing his thing meant that we never really saw each other. So we sold everything that we had.
Was he in Wellington as well?
No, this was in Auckland, yeah.
Okay.
I moved up to Auckland, and that's where we met. And
okay, so you were in Wellington doing community stuff, then you moved to Auckland, and that's where you two met.
Yeah, we met up here, and then, yeah, we decided to go traveling together. And for us, it was really make or break. Like, we knew that we were either going to go traveling and really, like, find what we were as a couple.
Sure.
Or we'd go traveling and we'd realize that probably we weren't ever going to be able to find the thing that could make us a unit.
Well, seeing how you're married and you have a restaurant together, I don't want to jump the gun, but I think you work. And what was traveling like? Did you go in thinking, I mean, maybe not a restaurant, but was it food-driven travel, or was it just sort of like, let's go see the world and whatever brings to us, and maybe we'll open an art gallery or something like that?
Oh, no, I mean, it was, yeah, I should rephrase this. It was traveling, but it was highly intentional. So we, Ed just basically contacted many restaurants that he was like, I would love the opportunity to do some time here, and he staged his way through these different restaurants.
That's so awesome.
So, to be honest, like I say, traveling, but we had maybe 2 days of a week where we could do something.
And were you doing photography at the time and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, I took all my gear and had great intentions. But the first place that we went was actually, you know, it's funny how you go away and you think you have this, like, maybe this will happen, maybe this won't. But the first place that we went actually, I think, cemented our future.
What place was it and where was it?
It was a restaurant called Keto, and they have a restaurant on an island called Bornholm,
mm-hmm.
and it's between Sweden and Denmark.
Oh yeah.
And
gorgeous,
amazing,
part of the world.
Amazing.
Gorgeous
place.
Yeah.
And they have this restaurant on this island, and their cuisine is very much about that island, you know. So the guys that started it, they were raised there, really passionate about it, and yeah, incredible what they've done. So the staff shuts down the Copenhagen City restaurant, and they all go there for the summer, and it's like a massive season.
Wow.
And they live in this little farmhouse, and 7 days a week operation, and they all roast it on, and it's like on a beach. Amazing. They've got gardens, and so Ed was in the kitchen, and I was gardening.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny how life prepares you for what you didn't know was
yeah.
coming.
Yeah.
How was your green thumb up in the Netherlands?
It was great. It was great. And I think, you know, that's one of the amazing things about this industry and, you know, being able to start, which I think is a real rite of passage for professional
Huge.
Chefs. And it's amazing what just those people that pass through your kitchen can actually give you. Like, for us, we came with this whole world of experience. Like I say, I mean, I'm South African, we're from New Zealand.
Sure.
So I knew heaps about plants that they didn't know. They knew heaps that I didn't know. And it's just that spirit of inquiry. Like, one day there's this amazing forest that, well, there's a few different forest reserves on the island, and we just took our bikes into one day and then just picked up this random pine cone that had fallen, and we were just like kind of exploring it and tasting it, and we were like, maybe this could be a thing. And then we took some back to them, and then they started testing, and now it's like on a dish, but they didn't know about it before.
That's so awesome. I mean, that's one of the beautiful things about community, and then a community built around a restaurant such as pasture and also the one that you're staging at, it's also time. Mm-hmm. It's also time to experiment and trust to sort of figure out, like, okay, we're doing it this way, but other people have other ideas, and because we trust the people and the community we've built, it's not my way or the highway. It's mm-hmm. like, no, it's like we're open to trying stuff.
Yeah.
And also putting yourself out there, you know, because you can have the confidence as well to be like, try these pine cones.
Yeah.
So you're staging around, and at what point did you and Ed feel that you two were ready or want to come back and start like exploring your own restaurant? And did you know that Auckland was the place that you were going to do it?
No, we didn't. You know, because Ed's originally from the UK and his family is still there. I'm originally from South Africa. Mm-hmm. I have some family in New Zealand, but you know, my mother, brother, extended family, they're all still on the vineyard that my family has in
Cape Town. Oh, you have a vineyard?
Yeah. So,
do you want to shout it out?
No, it's called Haut de Soie. And it's in Franschhoek, which is a tiny little valley. Most people know Stellenbosch as a wine region, yeah. But it's next to that. And it's beautiful. Yeah, it's transitioned to biodynamics, really tiny, really gorgeous. My family lives on the farm and produces the wine.
So. I'm seeing a pattern of living and loving where you work.
Yeah.
But is that, and we'll get into a little bit, but is that sort of where you started getting interested in natural wines and knowing that that's what you wanted to serve here?
Yeah, I mean, my family, I'm so privileged that I've grown up and my family's always just been like, amazing wine, amazing food.
Yeah.
You know, one of the most important lessons that my parents kind of taught me about wine is that there's no need to be like a jerk about it. It's not like a wanky thing.
No, it's not.
It's just what you like and just get out there and just taste heaps of things.
It's definitely become more democratic.
Mm.
As you have these like younger winemakers, and it's sort of become more like record collecting and things like that, and it's definitely been like, no, try our wines, like please try and stock our wines.
Yeah.
So you're traveling the world. You have ties to England. You have ties to South Africa. You're in the Netherlands. What brought you back to Auckland, and what made you want to open up this restaurant?
Well, yeah, I mean. After a time in Europe, Ed came to stay on the vineyard with me for 3 months. And we were seriously like going, man, South Africa, it's like, well, I mean, I love South Africa. I'm very passionate about it. And we were like, the produce there is amazing. Mm. Absolutely epic. It's like we could have literally opened a restaurant on my family's vineyard, and my mom has the most incredible gardens, just like what she manages to grow there is amazing. But in the end, we were just like, you know,
as much as you'd love to be right next to your parents all the time.
No, that wasn't it. It was just, you know, there. This is not what I want to talk about, but there are also reasons that I left South Africa.
Sure.
And I just didn't. Ed and I would love to have a family one day, and I just, yeah, I feel like New Zealand is a great country to. Raise kids in.
It's everyone's smiling.
Yeah.
And so you left, and then you came.
We left, and we came here. And
what year was this? How many years ago?
We came back. Oh, it's a little bit of a blur now. I think it was 2015.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're gonna take a quick break.
Yeah.
We're gonna talk about coming back to Auckland and then opening up Pasture here on Snacky Tunes. Song from our archives on heritageradionetwork.org.
Did anyone ever tell you? Now we're waiting patiently at mine. Let's give it a try. Something we both can agree to.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. I am with Laura Werner, one half the owners, founders of the Incredible Pasture in Auckland. So, 2015, you're coming back to Auckland with the pure intention of opening a restaurant?
Yeah, we really started talking about it in earnest when we were in South Africa. And, yeah, we came back to New Zealand with a really clear idea of where we wanted to be, and it wasn't in Auckland City. So we're both, I think, at heart country people, mm-hmm. love nature, and we were just like, oh man, wouldn't it be amazing to open up something really small in a food grown region of New Zealand where you could really kind of celebrate the provenance of the area. And so we set our hearts and minds to Clevedon.
Mm-hmm. Which, and where is that for those who are not familiar?
It's about 45 minutes out of Auckland.
Okay.
And it is an area which has got a mixed community of residents and a lot of farmland and mm-hmm. a lot of growers. They've got one of Auckland's best well-known like farmers markets. You know, there's buffalo out there, some like amazing mozzarella growers, different, like, yeah, really interesting stuff going on there. And bonus of it is that my father and my stepmom at the time, not at the time, she's still my stepmom, my father and my stepmom were living there at the time.
Got it.
And had a beautiful property, like, in the bush. So when New Zealanders say bush, they just mean, like, you know,
the countryside.
The native
yeah,
forest.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's a place that was very close to our hearts and is actually where we got married.
Oh. So it's got some... used it for something else.
Yeah. It was... We just really loved that area. So we came back and my stepmom is an artist and she's got this... She had this little kind of cabin in the forest there. And that's where we stayed. And we were just like, right, we got to find a site.
Yeah.
So just... searching and searching and searching, and yeah, after a lot of time and money and disappointment, what we realized is that there wasn't the infrastructure out there. Mm. Like, it's still a community that's on tank water in a lot of ways, and so
that is a tough way to run a restaurant.
It's really tough. And also, you know, after doing business planning and sort of like thinking about a lot, it was going to be really hard to get the covers. I mean, we opened a restaurant of 20 seats, and that's feasible in New Zealand's city with the biggest population.
Sure. When you know that the population is there. You always look at those places like Favicon, like the destination places, and go, what were those lean years like when you were building it up? Not now, when it's just like 6 months out, 8 months out.
Yeah.
And even being... in Auckland doesn't guarantee covers every night.
It doesn't. And I mean, if we were going to do like something...
which I want to add is a total shame.
It's getting there, but yeah. Like, you know, we've only been open for 6 months. So we're thrilled that we've had even like 10 people come to our restaurant.
So in opening for 6 months or in the planning, you know, one of the most impressive things, from the food to the wine to the bread to the insane olive oil, which you should 100% bottle and ship to us in LA, is you really, from the get-go, understand that you have a direct relationship with everything, all the products, all the produce, all the meat that's coming to the restaurant. Mm. How did you build those relationships?
Oh, it was just hard graft on his behalf. I mean, he spends, his waking life thinking about this place and the dishes, and he just searches and phones and phones and phones, and probably out of 20 phone calls he might get one connection.
Really?
Yeah.
Is it because you're working with such small producers that all their stuff is already accounted for?
I mean, it's I think about this a lot because it, you know, I've got that kind of community systems brain, and things like sustainability really matter to me, and I try to put myself in the shoes of small producers in a tiny country like New Zealand a lot, and they've got a lot of challenges, you know.
Yeah.
And the literally, and you know, in a wider sense, the landscape of our relationship to food has changed so drastically, and places like tiny countries, I think, really manifest that a lot. So yeah, I mean, we often contact people, we're like, hey, we like found you through this way or that way, and they're just like, yeah, well, that's great, like, but how do I send it to you?
Right.
You know,
like that,
there's,
oh my God,
not the infrastructure, and there's those really simple things that, you know, when you're just like, but you've got this thing that we want, and we've got this outlet, and we're going to pay you for it, but it just won't happen because the infrastructure isn't there.
Right, because the cost to get it on a truck or a plane to get it here is just prohibitive.
Yeah, and I mean, I think we are probably one of the only restaurants in, I mean, I don't want to say New Zealand, but it's like, we pay like $150 a month to recycle like the polystyrene that our produce has to come to us in.
That's amazing.
And I wish it didn't come in polystyrene, like, at all.
At all.
But at least...
but if it's got to linger and take care of it.
But that's, for example, one of the things that we just have to do. Because if we're not going through a major supplier... and I mean, even some of, like, the artisan growers, the tiny guys, they're linked to bigger produce companies.
Sure.
Because that network is just there. And I understand that and I support it. Like, I want them to be able to focus on growing their amazing produce and having security And if it means that, oh, I've got to like sign up to this kind of bigger company that where a lot of their produce is just like, we wouldn't ever touch it, but they're the access route to these little guys, then that's just what we have to do.
Do you see pasture, given your background, as a larger scale network and your chance to build a new type of community in the food infrastructure system in New Zealand?
I'd love it to be. You know, that's one of our intentions, and I know that we're not the only people in New Zealand who, you know, are really quite vocal about, you know, wanting to have access to this amazing produce, and we realize that we're one of the links in this chain.
Yeah.
Like, we can either affect change or we can just be, you know, okay with the status quo and just buying into the system, which we don't want to do. You know, I mean, we don't, for example, like, it's taken us convincing and really a lot of talking to even, like, get this lamb supply that we have on now.
I mean, that lamb, well, thank you for talking to him. Because of that lamb. Well, let's talk about the food. So you opened up, what's crazy in reading about you in advance and then coming here is how clear of a point of view that you have as a restaurant, which is, you know, there's all the planning in the world and talking about what you want to do, but then when, you know, when it actually comes time to logistics, you go like, okay, this is what we want, this is where we have to go in a couple of years to get there, but it feels that in 6 months, it feels fully realized.
Mm-hmm.
I have a good idea of how you got to your philosophy, but how have you been able to stick with your philosophy day in, day out from the get-go? Or is it just, there's just no bending? Or when you do bend, you go like, this is just to keep the doors open, and we know that we're working to like this very clean, like pure goal.
Mm. Interesting question. Again, I credit it. I mean, you know, what manifests on the plate is really, you know, that's him.
It's not just the plate though, because it's the drinks and the service and the space itself.
Yeah. I mean, no, we don't want to bend. And I think in the beginning it was a lot easier for us because, I mean, it's that I'm making that bell curve shape with my hand. It's that what's the term? Like early adoption. You know, we had the early adopters where they'd followed us on Instagram.
Sure.
They kind of heard about us through the movement. And so, you know, we had some great support when we were opened. It was amazing. Like, the media really got behind us, and we had a real opportunity to try to say to people, we're different.
Yeah.
Like, this is what we're going to be. So if you come expecting this, this, and this, we're going to disappoint you, and you'll be frustrated, and we'll be frustrated.
And look, we only have 20 seats, so, like, just come and grab some bread on the weekend. We'll say you've been here.
Yeah.
You can post a photo.
If only. Yeah.
Fresh bread and pasture. And then that way you're not that upset. But that's... I feel like that's not exactly what happened.
No. I mean, it's like we've created something when people either, like, really love it and really get into it and I think can identify with it, or we get people who just hate it. Like, every week at the moment, we're having just, like, a table or a couple of tables that is just, like, what is this?
But I don't understand that, because more than, sometimes you have to search for the mission of the restaurant. Mm. And you guys are so clear about it, between the website and your newsletter and, like, what you post about on Instagram. How do people wind up here not really knowing what they're getting into?
Because they've just heard the name.
Sure.
and they haven't gone any deeper than that. Or it's like, we're like the buzz at the moment, which I'm so grateful for. But at the same time, it's really tough when you get these people like, oh, I've heard so much about you. And then they're just like, they just have one bite of a dish and they just push it aside and even get up and leave before the final dishes come out. And it's you know, it's one of those things where it's like, I feel like this is just going to be something where we just dig in and just kind of go, I'm like, and I'm genuinely sorry that people don't enjoy it, because this is such, it's an outpouring of us that of course you're like, oh man, they're like, they're not having a good time, and I feel responsible for that because I want to host people and feed people well.
Of course.
And
but if you it's you know, for a small place, especially for a tasting menu, where I feel, at least in the States, you know, tasting menus have really been left to the people who have dug in, as you said. Like, there was a craze where it was like, everyone's doing a tasting menu, something like this, and now it's like, this is what we stand for, this is what we're in, and we are going to give you an awesome experience, but we expect the same out of you to come in with an open mind.
Yeah.
And I, you know, and you guys doing a 6-course menu, I mean, the first dish last night after the incredible bread and olive oil, but it's, you know, tomatoes, blueberries, pepper, you know, it's like not... And I've never had blueberries and tomatoes before. We just haven't, especially not with pepper. And we leaned into it. We're like, this is amazing. But hearing what you're saying, I can see people going like, what is this?
Yeah. Yeah. It's, and, you know, to be honest, you know, like, we know those tables before we've even taken them the first snack. Because it's like, that's why we go up to the table and we bring you like a towel warmed with essential oils and we present our menu in a certain way. And I know that you can just tell, some tables just close off and they're like, why is she talking to me? I'm like, because you've come into my home in many ways, and I'm trying to A, welcome you, but B, this is a really important moment here between you as a diner and us as a... as a restaurant, as a space, as a staff, where we're going to just let you know a little bit more about us in case you didn't, you know. And we've even printed a manifesto on the front of our menu, which is just like, we cook over fire. We like flavors of fermentation because it's not for everyone. People complain that our desserts aren't sweet enough. People complain about this and that. And it's just kind of like, well, you know, I'm sorry, but... we don't want to give you venison and licorice. We don't want to give you mushroom and chicken. Like,
and you're not. And just to be clear, you're not saying that that's bad. But you can go to another restaurant to get that. But if you want something that is a very clear point of view and very defined, something different.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the food, because it is. I'm. Sometimes you sit back from a meal and you go like, I just had something special. And I feel like that was last night. And I think what really sealed it for me... I mean, the whole thing was awesome. I don't want to... We could spend a whole hour going course by course. But the lamb. And the fact that Ed said last night that you bring in a whole lamb, which is crazy because this place is not that big. I was surprised. I was like, oh, maybe he brings in half a lamb. But the fact that you're bringing a whole lamb is awesome. But there's something that you said when we were talking before this about you don't garnish for pretty looks. Like, you only add for anything. And the lamb that came out was 3 pieces of lamb on the plate and then a lamb rib tucked in a paper bag, which was, I loved it. And then you poured fermented lamb stock over it. And there was no... microgreens, there was nothing. And you know, sometimes when I go to, when you go to these tasting menus, you go like, oh my god, there is so much on this plate that is completely unnecessary. But I feel like that lamb dish, and especially what you're saying about the lamb purveyor thing, was like, I was like, this is the thesis.
Yeah.
And it's one meat dish.
Yeah.
And you're not like, there was no toss away chicken dish. It was like, here we go, we're hanging our hat on the one big meat dish, and it delivered. So how does Ed and you and the kitchen develop these menus? And then how did you guys get the confidence just to be like, this is it?
Yeah, well, I, you know, thank you for saying that. We've been open for 6 months and we've only served...
which, again, I have to say, is so crazy.
we've in that time, we served pork. And we've served lamb. So this is this year since we've opened. We reopened on the 18th of January. Is the year that we've served lamb. And the reason we've done only pork and lamb is because we've got some really strict criteria about the suppliers that we want to work with. And with the meat, it has to be direct to the farmer. I mean, I mean, yeah.
There's no bending on that.
No.
There's no signing up for the larger aggro guys. No, it's like, and I get that.
Yeah. And I like the same with the people that we got the pork through. It's like, they actually bring it to pasture. Mm. There's none of, you know, it's amazing. So,
do you want to shout them out?
We've worked with Longbush Pork, and then we worked with Farmgate, and the lamb guy, actually I don't know their name, I process their invoices, but I think Edward, like, he has nurtured that relationship to this point, so I'm like, I'm not gonna
yeah.
If
you search lamb guys New Zealand, they pop up, right?
No, they don't.
Really? Oh,
and
it's that, like,
and that's an example of it took him 3.5 months to find them. And now sometimes it's even like when we have customers in here, like we had a delivery of 14 lamb last week. 14.
Here?
Here.
14 whole lamb.
14 whole lamb, because Ed ages them. So
how long does he age them for?
Ideally he'd be aging them for 3 weeks to a month.
Funky rot.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the secret of all good food.
Yeah.
You can call it age, you can call it whatever you want, but it is that decomposition that gives it that flavor.
Yeah, that's true.
So he ages the lamb, or all the meat, and then he cooks it over...
He cooks it over fire. And so it's the same, the pork and the lamb, they require very different cooking techniques.
Sure.
Like the pork, we'd have to light the fire at 11 in the morning, and every 20 minutes he'd be turning. So intensive.
You can get someone who wants a stage just to turn the meat.
Yeah.
You have one job every 20 minutes.
I don't think Ed would actually ever give it up. It's like, he loves cooking.
Oh my God.
So
when
much,
he,
yeah.
when he was handling the leg of lamb and playing on carving, I was like, no one's getting between the chef and the meat.
No. And, so where was I going with this? You were asking me about the meat. So, yeah, with the pork, I mean, we were serving, like, many of the same things. It's, like, it's cooked over the fire. It's on the fire when the guests come here. It's pulled off the fire and it's carved for that table, you know, very, very specific. But the pork, we were actually using garnishes, not many. The same principle which guides our entire menu is it has a purpose of being there, or it doesn't. And the pork we were serving was some wild wood sorrel, which I would forage some fermented berries and pickled spruce. And that was it. And again, a sauce. It was our own elderflower wine and roasted pork fat. And, you know, beautiful. But it was a piece of meat covered in this, like, yeah, I mean. Anyway, it was a stunning dish. People really loved it. But with this one, I think because we've gone even further into, like, the whole animal.
Dug in even deeper.
It's like with the pork, we were getting in whole joints. And I mean, the guanciale that you had last night, it was like we were saving and curing. So it's like we really believe in this philosophy of minimal waste and using every part. But yeah, with the lamb, I mean, Ed was just thinking about it and he was just like, I really want to honor this animal.
Yeah.
And I don't want to confuse this dish. It's like, it is all about the lamb.
It is. It's the most lamb dish I've ever had. And it is so... I mean, it's a confident dish. Mm. Because there's no hiding.
No.
I know we're running a little short on time, but I'd be remiss to not talk about the beverage program.
Mm.
So I know that you do natural wines, and it's fantastic, and I think I read you're the only Auckland restaurant that does all natural.
We're the only restaurant in New Zealand, yeah.
Take that, all of New Zealand, north and south out. So how do you source that wine, being the only one? Because if you want to talk about community infrastructure, you're the only one who's serving all natural wines. That has to be a bit of a research game as well.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. And really, yeah, a lot of just building up these relationships, going directly to a lot of vineyards. But we've got one main supplier who's just it's just amazing. And he gets us, we get him.
Isn't it
awesome?
It's
a great relationship. And I mean, it's a benefit. There's so many benefits to being this small. There's so many risks to being this small. But the benefits are, you know, and we said this to a lot of wine people. It's like, if you make something weird, even if it's just like 20 bottles, we want it.
Yeah.
You know, because we're that small that we can do something really powerful with it. And
I mean, that sparkling we're using last night, the unfiltered one, I was like, this is a weird wine.
Yeah.
I mean, it was awesome, but I was like, oh, this falls in the someone's having fun. And then you gave it a home.
Yeah.
And in addition to your wine program, you also do a lot of fermenting.
Yeah.
And making your own type of drinks. What do you make here that's not part of... Because you can have a whole tasting that is not alcoholic and have it be just as wild and awesome.
Yeah, I mean, we call that one the pasture match. We were initially calling it a juice match, but it felt like people weren't getting it. They were just like,
yeah.
Ooh, I don't want to have apple juice and orange juice. It's like, no, it's not
no,
that.
No, dude, it's not. We're not cracking a bottle of Mott's.
Yeah, it's in a way, it's like a second tasting menu. Because we make it all here, and it's designed specifically for that dish. So I love it when, like, tables, if they're a couple and they order one of the drinks match and then one of the pasta match, and they're always just like, whoa, this is so interesting. And the wines are so different to the juices, and it's just a real talking point. So, yeah, I mean, it includes shrubs, for example, is what's matched to the tomato dish. So the shrub. We made a raspberry vinegar ourselves last year, and it's that, and is one of the components of the drink. And then we ferment things like with kombucha and kefir grains, and then we do infusion and fresh juicing. So yeah, it's really complex. A lot of and we try to think about, you know. Sorry, my dog is squeaking.
It's okay. Dogs are 100% allowed to squeak on this show.
We think about it, you know, I try to think about it as a sommelier might think, well, what's my pairing? You know, what's the structure of the drink? What's the mouthfeel? You know, we try to recreate a tannin structure by using, you know, tea infusions and things like that. So it's really creative and it's really fun.
I think the moment I realized that, I mean, there were so many moments last night in the meal where I realized that this was something special, but when we were drinking the sake, the only sake that's grown in New Zealand, and then the very nice waitress was explaining how they hang it, and that's how it drips down, and then you take what's left over from the hanging, and that is what made the broth for, like, this cucumber dish. I was like, this is a community.
Yeah.
This is something special.
Yeah.
So thank you. If people want to find you, and my recommendation is to get in now before you have to wait 6 months. Where can people find you? Where can people sign up for the newsletter?
We have a website, which is pastureakl.com.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to be pretty active on Instagram.
You have a good Instagram game.
Yeah.
It's strong. What is it, the same thing?
at pasture_akl, I think.
It is.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
It is.
Yeah, and I think that's a great medium for us to be able to convey a lot of what's going on behind the scenes and then a finished dish. So I like Instagram. Well, I used to be a photographer, so it's
yeah,
fun.
I like Instagram too. I don't tweet anymore. I don't do Snapchat, but I love Instagram.
Yeah,
all day. Just look at food. I go, oh yeah, that's great. Well, Laura, thank you so much. Thank you to Ed. Thank you to the entire seven person team, which. When I found out that number last night, I was like, that is such an amazing number of people for the amount of work that you guys are doing. So, anyway, congratulations.
Thank
I could
you.
Talk for more and more and more. We have another song coming up from the archives and then a live performance here on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org.
I could have sworn time when we believed that we could measure out our lives just how we wanted it, so we could live just as long as anybody ever did. But I was wrong to lie like that. I was wrong to lie like that. And when the air was so cold that that it smelled sweet on your coat, and the concrete got swollen and roared and it swallowed you whole. I said, don't try to argue with it, it will take you home. It's just another road under the one you used to know. But I lied to you, I didn't have a choice but to. I lied to you. And I can't hide forever and remain ashamed of it. I can't cover my hands and tell you not to blame me. That you are a speck in a pile of dust, and everything you love will turn into crumbs. So stop worrying, worrying, worry some love. Stop worrying, worry some love. And the bells and the whistles make deafening sounds, and you can see an ending, it's clear as a bell, when the sound of your headache is louder than hell. In the bend of a note, you're alone. In the bend of a note, you're alone, you're alone. So don't waste it all worrisome.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a national nonprofit network with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Chefs Collaborative members work to make sustainable practices second nature for every chef in the United States. Chefs Collaborative was founded in 1993 by visionary chefs including Rick Bayless and Alice Waters, who acknowledged the influential role of food professionals on our food choices, our collective personal health, the vitality of cultures, and the integrity of the global environment. Chefs Collaborative believes that the greater culinary community can be a catalyst for positive change by expanding the market for good food and helping to preserve local farming and fishing communities. Change menus, change lives. Learn more about Chefs Collaborative at chefscollaborative.org.
Welcome back. We have Jordan and Byron of Lover live in studio. Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And it seems like we have some shared history.
We do.
Best man at the wedding of your old roommate, and you worked with Darren for Popular Noise.
Correct.
So let's start with your backgrounds. Byron will go first.
Okay.
Obviously, because I said Popular Noise and also Violent Bullshit as well. Incredible band. Great pins, by the way. I always thought that the pin game was super strong.
Yeah, I mean, also the T-shirts were very special.
Yeah, it's really excellent. So let's talk about Popular Noise.
Sure.
For people who don't know, maybe a quick overview and you know what you've put out, both the magazine and also the 7 inches.
Sure. Actually, this is sort of a good place to start, also because it's originally where Jordan and I kind of first met. So the Journal of Popular Noise I started as kind of like my final project in school when I was at Parsons, probably like 2006 or 2007, something mm-hmm. like that. And Jordan and I first met when I was working at V Magazine and she was an intern there. And when she left the magazine, she started, we struck up a friendship and she started helping me out with what I was doing with the Journal of Popular Noise. And that went on for a few years.
What is Popular Noise?
Oh, so like the idea behind it was that it was sort of a periodical, like audio magazine. So there was sort of a format that I would reach out to different artists to kind of react to. So we maybe in total did each issue kind of came with 3 7-inches. Mm. So we had a pretty wide variety. There was some like weird noise stuff. There was some, totally like pop. There was like a Japanese pop band that did one. Andrew WK did a spoken word one, which was really crazy.
Was there an overarching philosophy behind it or an approach that allowed you to fold in all of that music?
It was sort of, the whole thing was really about trying to explore this crossover between, magazines and periodicals, which I was really into, like as a graphic designer, but also, having a background in music, I always felt like there was this, a lot of similar mechanisms in play, of just like the classic pop song structures that everybody gravitates towards, being kind of similar to the standards of like a magazine design and structure.
And is it archived? Or can it be found? Is it ongoing?
Or a more recent iteration.
Right. I did, you know, more recently, Popular Noise Magazine, which was like a much more traditional format for a magazine, but it was kind of all about, you know, like art, lifestyle, culture, like around the world of music. Mm. But the Journal of Popular Noise stuff was, it's probably not anywhere online or anything like that. You know, it's been mildly defunct for a while. But the whole, it was all very much like this fetishist, like letterpress printed, super limited edition, everything's numbered, it's all vine. You know, it was kind of like obnoxious.
Completist
in that way.
Type vibes, like, yeah, it must be this way.
Right.
So starting a new one, you know all the work that goes into it, and it's exactly. Like, it's a mountain. And then Jordan, obviously you didn't stay an intern. I know that you're also a writer, and you've also been in a number of gallery shows. So what is your work outside of the music world, and what is your approach to it as well?
I was really trying to be a fine artist until recently. And I realized with this band actually that that's really not something that I want to do. But I direct video, I write, I work in fashion and in advertising, doing commercial production. And I wasn't the studio director for an artist for a number of years. Mm. So I've always been involved in creative projects in a number of ways. And I am, my goal now, especially in the band is really wrapped up in this, is to get deeper into directing video. So we have ideas for videos, and we've kind of decided that we want to be directing most of them ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, it's great from the booklet and everything. It shows like a strong hand that you art directed all of it, I'm sure, from both your backgrounds and just more creative control. Or if you were to bring someone else in, you can push them to a level of like, we can already do this.
Right.
How can you beat us?
Exactly.
Which I always think is the best approach. And then how did you go from former intern to bandmates?
Well, we've been I mean, that really was just the way that we became friends. And I guess because I was really eager to get involved in projects in the arts that were going on outside of school when I was, obviously I was interning when I was in school when I met Byron. And so starting to help him with the journal, I think we became closer friends and we've just always kept in touch and worked on projects together.
I think I had a very like honest approach to, you know, the feedback that I give my friends, especially about their creative work, which, you know,
can, we definitely have that kind of,
to put
of,
it nicely.
Yeah.
Is it like an honest feedback? Is it a raw feedback? Is it brutal?
It's a lot of tough love.
It's pretty brutal. Yeah.
I've gotten better, but I think that's part of why we got along was that like,
both of us are like that.
Yeah. We're both like that. And we both know if we want like a real, you know, honest.
Have you made friends cry with your feedback?
Probably, yeah.
Oh, man.
Jordan, I think you made me cry. But I think we really became friends because I kind of gave it back to you right away before we knew each other very well.
There's things I wouldn't even repeat that Jordan has said, and she knows what I'm talking about.
They're like, this interview is over. You said you would never even acknowledge that I said that. So then how did the Lover Project come about? I mean, in the sense that you guys were friends, but like begin to like, hey, we want to start making music together. We want to start.
The band before Byron came in with Crystal Nava, who is a drummer. She was formerly the drummer in a band called LA Witch. Mm-hmm. And she had moved to New York kind of recently, just before I met her. And wanted to be in a band here. I've been sort of secretly a musician my entire life. Mm. But I've never, this is my first proper band that's mine with my songs. There's a handful of people that I've exposed myself as a singer and songwriter to that have asked me into their projects, but Crystal was sort of willing to be patient with me as somebody new to having a band. And we started the band together with another bass player who couldn't really commit. And then Byron.
Bass players, am I right?
Tell me about it.
Yeah. And then Byron came in and started playing bass. And then last year, Crystal couldn't play with us anymore, so Byron moved to the drum kit.
Amazing. Can we hear a song?
Yes.
What are you going to play for us first?
I'm going to play a song called Berlin.
Great.
That is about the club Berlin.
Oh, the club Berlin?
Yeah.
We
named the song because I didn't know what to name the song. We were about to go to Berlin to go do something.
This might be a first and maybe a last.
Probably.
Well, I mean, I think Lana Del Rey is putting a song out called Tenants of the Trees, which is that like uber hipster bar in LA. So you're in interesting company. All right. Well,
it's just funny because the club Berlin has like nothing to do with this.
Yeah.
Song.
And it's spelled with a Y.
Is it?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Berlin with a Y.
Oh, well, yeah. I misspelled it.
Okay.
All right.
Here we go. Lover live on Snacky Tunes.
Every morning I wake up, it's getting harder to grow up. Time and time and time again, I live for love and lose a friend. Invite you in to shake things up. Don't give a damn that it's gonna be rough. But time and time I spend alone. Sounding better on the phone. Sounding better on the phone. In a future perfect tense, never said. Time again, we cut the cord for another friend. But I don't need another friend. Could have said that was the end. But time and time I spend alone, sounding better on the phone. Sounding better on.
One of the interesting things about the two of you working together now, I think, is much clearer because you have such an honest relationship, is the band philosophy and your approach to the music. It seems so fully formed. We'll get to the pledge in a second because I think that's really incredible and I love it so much. I read it so many times. But let's talk with the larger philosophy and the approach to it and kind of the minimalism and emotional expressionism that comes through the record, the lyrics, even the graphic design to a point.
Sure. I mean, I guess like you know, when we first started doing this, we, you know, really talked a lot about how, you know, because of our backgrounds individually, in all the other creative aspects, that, like, you know, we wanted to use this band as, you know, a means to not just do, you know, do music, but, like, as kind of a vehicle to explore these other things, you know, of, like, the design, the just sort of, like, the idea of how we represent ourselves, making videos, you know.
Right. But at the end of, that doesn't mean that at the end of the day, the most important thing isn't the songs. That's definitely the most important thing. But it's the, I think that we both see the songs as a jumping off point to create a world that is a larger emotional expression. And that's really what the, I would say the crux of the project is valuing feeling and valuing emotional expression over instrumental virtuosity. And we both kind of agreed that what can happen and what we have seen happen with bands that sort of think too much about what they're doing is the music can get kind of
right
and that- boring. And while it's like what we're doing, you could say is boring, but I think it's much more interesting to have the challenge of expressing yourself fully with very little.
Right. I mean, and in my experience in playing music, you know, like when I was younger, I was, you know, much more into the musical virtuosity and, like, you know, trying really hard to be as complex as possible. And, you know, I think that the reaction I got from that was that nobody cared.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that the more you focus...
One dude was like, nice.
Yeah, exactly. There was, it was like this crazy death metal band, and there was like...
What was it called?
It was called Cepheid, which was like also a terrible name. And I remember specifically, there was one show, I must have been like 22 or 23, and like after we played... This guy who seemed like a million years old to me, he was probably like 35, with like a green goatee, like came up to me. He was like, dude, that was fucking awesome. Yeah.
Right.
I swear. Sorry.
That's fine.
Okay. And I was like, there's something wrong here.
Right.
This like, is I'm not doing, this is yeah, not, what I should
you
be
are
doing.
Not, you are not my end goal here.
Exactly.
But a lot of the greatest, creativity comes from constraint. And I think when everything's an option, you kind of are just almost paralyzed. So putting these rules on you, especially when you're starting a new project where you both have such diverse backgrounds and can pull from anything, it's nice to have those roadblocks to be like, you know, we could do this, but, and they're not off the table, but for now we work inside this framework in this world in which we built.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I'm also literally, I'm not a guitar player. I mean, obviously.
Like, yeah. That was some nice strumming.
I mean, yeah, but like, you know, literally constrained by having no skills.
I mean, I feel like the whole like punk scene was just built on not being any type of instrument player.
Right. And like, you know, there's another thing that we talk about a lot, which is like, you know, when you don't have all the tools, but you're inspired to do something and you're trying, you know, you're doing the best that you can to try to emulate something. And by not being good at it, you accidentally make something even more interesting than if you were able to copy perfectly the thing that you liked.
Right. There, I mean, again, it's, you also don't have any of the preconceived notions of what you can and can't do by being within a field. You're just like, I think you can do it like this.
Right.
Then you just do it. The pledge that you put together.
Right.
I mean, it's broken into two parts. We can start with the overall philosophy of it first, which is essentially like, I mean, what I took was like disengage from the internet and social media and the digital and engage with the people around you.
Yeah.
Where did this come from? And then what was the idea of including this with the record and just generally sharing it with your fans?
Well, it was actually Byron really was the heart of that project. So I'll let him talk more about it. But we created it as a takeaway for a special video screening that we did when our video was finished before it was released online. So it was, that was the first kind of party that we did that wasn't a show, that was an effort to kind of create a community around what we were doing in a different way. And we wanted to do something special for it. And we both had some feelings about the socio-political landscape that Byron can talk more about.
Well, I mean, I think that originally what really inspired that and some other stuff was, you know, after, you know, after the election, you know, Jordan and I were just talking, like, we, you know, just feeling very much like we needed to do something, mm-hmm. You know, and, you know, we talked a lot about what that was going to be. And so we had this event planned, and we kicked around a lot of ideas. And, you know, I think that we decided together to work to write this thing, or to have some sort of, you know, message around it. And the video, you know, the concept behind that and the song, it was like, you know, there's, you know, we did it obviously before the election, but it was like, you know, a lot of themes of like fascism and power, right. And like, you know,
it kind of came together naturally.
Yeah.
We realized that what we were doing with the video made a lot of sense and was sort of accidentally relevant.
And which song is it for?
Romantic Depot.
Right. And so, you know, when thinking about like what it was that we wanted to say, I think that I wanted to make sure that it was, you know, ultimately a positive message. And I saw so much like of, you know, what I was feeling and what I think led to the place that we're in right now, having a lot to do with, you know, how obsessed everybody is with their phones and their, yeah. you know, apps and their things. And it's, you know, under this sort of
Byron
understanding.
Actually deleted all of his apps.
He's you know,
fully
after,
off the grid, no location services. Sorry, ladies.
I'm in the back of Roberta's right now if you're looking for me.
You have 20 you have 20 minutes.
But, you know, I just felt like so much of the, you know, how we ended up in the place that we are right now is because of, you know, this, you know, and being this divided country where people have their own personal bubbles that are curated by their feeds and they only see the world that they want to see. And in sort of under the guise of being a community or online community or connecting with other people, it's right. actually making us more alienated from each other. You know, it's like...
Because everyone has this kind of false idea that they're in touch without actually being in touch because they're only seeing a filtered version of what everyone else projects as themselves and their reality.
Sure. And then there's also just like, you know, the proliferation of, you know, just falsehoods and like you just don't know any like who to trust or yeah. what is real. You know, haters will say it's Photoshop.
Right.
or fake news or whatever the thing. And I think by, you know, getting out of that, it's really, I don't know, it's just like really important. And to go back to the video event thing, why we decided to, you know, have this was, you know, about, you know, sharing this thing with our friends and our community in a real way in real time with like actual people in right. a room.
Right, something you know? To take away.
And exactly. people really read it, and it was, people weren't on their phones at that. Mm-hmm. They were experiencing the thing and reading the pamphlet and talking about it.
If someone hands you the beginning of an event, and then you just go, I don't know, mm-hmm. what's going on Instagram? I mean, it's, again, could people get this online, or is there anywhere that, just how about this, email the band.
Right.
Yeah, write them a handwritten letter, and you can mail it to them.
Right.
Self-addressed stamp.
Well, but the other thing that we've talked about is, because, you know, we also, Byron is... What are you, like 10 years older than me? Because you're just over the millennial bracket,
right, like,
and then I'm definitely millennial.
You're in it, yeah.
And so we've had conversations, because one of the things we were talking about was promoting the record, promoting shows. How do we do that without, you know, to me, I'm like, we can't, you know, delete Facebook for right. the band. We have to use it. So it's sort of this, but you know, that's part of it is just creating that conversation, having that dialogue and being more aware.
Right. Can we hear another song?
Sure.
What are you going to play?
I'm going to play Romantic Depot.
Perfect.
Which is, I guess, the single. Do we have a single?
Something like that.
Hit me with your silence, babe. Monster. choice is all. Don't let that. Don't let that. In a mirror, I see you. And all the things you put me through. Help me, heaven, make me whole. It's scary, it's so good. Buried deep down there, in the depths of misery, is dying for some love. Is dying for some love.
That's it.
That's it. Let's talk about the new record. Am I Safe? Out on Friday, this past Friday. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Really well done. It was on Spotify, so I don't know how that fits into the philosophy, but it's on Spotify. You look pained.
Well, no, there's actually a lot. There's a fine print in the pamphlet that says delete social media where possible.
It's the out.
Right.
It's a loophole.
So you
use it responsibly.
Use it responsibly. So you put out a single in 2015, and the record is out. How did it come to be, and how did you end up meeting the sweet, sweet, sweet Andrew Poso, who we love so much?
Byron already knew Andrew. Yeah.
Well, do you want to talk about the record, and then I can...
Sure. How did the record come about? This first record is really an iteration of the kind of coming together of the band as a whole project, so these are kind of the best of all of the songs that we've written over the last 3 years since we've been a band, I would say. And Byron and I started working on the record with our drummer who ended up not being able to continue playing with us when we, right around the time we started recording. So we kind of redeveloped the material with our friend Drew Citron, who's in a band called Beverly. And she was really supportive, helping us kind of do a first pass at the recording and reconfiguring the lineup. We kind of worked everything out that way. I obviously write all the words and guitar parts. Byron writes everything else. And we collaborate on how things should sound, but we kind of worked all of that out, I would say, in the studio with Drew to start, and then we went to Jonathan Krynick and kind of did a final recording of the record.
And with the creative constraint, I mean, did you, as it evolved together, did you go back and redo some of the songs, or like when they got into the studio, they were pretty much incorporative of the philosophy and ready to go?
I mean, do you mean... What do you mean by...
Like, did you run... Like, as your philosophy developed as a band, did the songwriting structure change? And, like, when you finally... Like, where you started, and then as you evolved the philosophy, did the songs change or the structure? They get more stripped down?
I don't think so.
No, I mean, the songwriting didn't necessarily change, but I think that, you know, what we were able to do in the studio was kind of, like, layer things a little bit more.
Right.
And, like, you know, add in and think about, like, you know, how to give the right emphasis in the right places, you know, to kind of make the songs as they were written a little bit more powerful. And I think also in the process of, like, you know, readjusting our lineup, you know, me having to transition from bass to drums, it was, you know, it was
developmental period for
totally.
Us becoming like the heart of the band as a more of a duo. And we did a lot of exploring in the studio of ways that we could manage to deal with all the different parts of the songs with just two people, I would say. And there were some happy accidents that happened, especially when we did the final recording with Jonathan. And I, as a musician, definitely learned a lot in the studio and became more confident and started experimenting more.
Yeah. And I think really, you know, the part of what makes, our musical, collaboration, like, work really well is that, I mean, you know, like, I couldn't actually like write an entire song or lyrics or anything like to save my life. And you know, but what I can do and what my role has always been in all the bands that I've done is like the second guitar player or the bass player or the, you know, the kind of supporting role. So like, you know, both Jordan and I like do totally different things that work perfectly together of, you know, how we can, you know, what needs to get done.
And we have a very like familial kind of relationship and know each other so well that we actually don't, it works well because we don't need to talk about what one or the other means. We operate with the same language. And just knowing about each other's lives, it's like, I can come to Byron with a new song. We don't have to talk about what it's about. He can just tell, or he knows, or whatever.
I mean, that's easily one of the hardest things to find is just a good partner. Mm-hmm. And then all the other things kind of build off of that. And how did you come to put this record out on Concierge and work with Andrew?
So Andrew's been a friend for a long time, great guy. Like, I think I originally met him through, you know, Jay Green and, you know, all of those guys. And he was always a big fan of Violent Bullshit. Like, I think we played...
Who wasn't?
I don't know, my mom.
Yeah.
but, you know, he... I think we played more than one of his birthday parties. So, and, you know, he shares the studio where we recorded with Jonathan Krennic. And so, you know, he came in, you know, we would run into him there. And, you know, yeah. he liked what we were doing. And
I didn't meet him, or I met him maybe once at Iona or something. But right. I really met him while we were in the middle of recording.
Yeah. And, you know, and so we talked, you know, he was curious about what we wanted to do with it. And, you know, we were trying to reach out to labels and trying to talk to different people about it. And, you know, and then finally he was like, well, why don't I just help you guys out? And we'll, you know, we'll put it out. And we're about to relaunch the Concierge website. And, you know, he's got a couple of other great releases coming out or have come out recently. I like Lily and Frame. And mm-hmm. I think the band he's playing with, Hess, is more.
Yeah.
So he's just like, we'll just put it.
Amazing.
We'll just put it in there. It's no, yeah. You know, because it's a digital only release at the moment. So it was really, you know.
Right in line with that philosophy.
Exactly.
When applicable. Well, record is out on Friday. Any shows coming up? Any tours? What's on deck?
We have a few special shows at different kinds of places up our sleeve that we will be announcing soon.
Okay.
Super secret.
Well, I want to
very secret.
I want to thank you for coming on. Where can people find you? Get the record. Instagram,
the record,
email, get the pledge.
you know, I think I'm going to put the pledge up on our website. But we are on Instagram as Lover Is Taken, because it was taken. Facebook, we are on Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, I think,
yeah,
now.
Basically,
yeah, Amazon, all the digital
all
stuff.
The
if you need to find me, I'll be on Callier Street, Beckford and McGinnis most of the time.
I have a private Instagram that you can search for if you want.
Cool. Well, I want to thank our guest, Pastor from New Zealand. If you are ever down that way, please make sure and go eat there. It's one of the best meals that we've ever had. Thank you for tuning this. In this week, we'll be back with another episode of Snacky Tunes. What are you going to take us out with?
I'm going to play a song that we are working on for the next record.
Great. What's it called? Titled yet? Or
it's called Make It Last.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us, and we'll see you all next week.
Hold up, man, who understands? I'm gonna take it for a change of plans. Got the key so you can leave. Save your money and go. Soak yourself all night in me. The way I kissed your eyes, your tears. At the morning you can leave, just the smell of me. down to shit. I need a push and you're not it. The city's falling, shame on me. I think I need a chill. I'm not sorry that I lied. I can't make it over tonight. 'Cause when you speak, the world turns white. And I can't stand myself. Maybe you're a real man, and I should give you half a chance. Talk is tired, you talk too fast, and I'm too wiped to make it
talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody. I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Thing.